Hey, Casey Scott here from Project Recovery Podcast. When I took my first steps towards confronting my addiction, I needed a program that could help guide me through my recovery. That's why I wanted to tell you about Reprieve Recovery. They are a recovery center for women that recognize the importance of healing the spirit, mind, body, and are located in beautiful Mountain Green, Utah. You can learn more by calling 801-252-6030 or visiting their website at reprieverc.com.
Hey, welcome to Project Recovery. It's a podcast about addiction, but more importantly, it's a podcast about recovery. I'm Casey Scott. If you know somebody who needs some help, have them do what I did and give Pinnacle Recovery Center a call. They'll get you on your way to recovery. Dr. Matt?
How you doing?
When are you going to get that haircut?
Well, so
I mean, you've been threatening us with a good time for about three episodes now.
Well, I will say that I hate getting my hair cut.
I do, too.
Absolutely hate
You know when they go,
haircut.
Hey, do you want your hair washed and massaged? No, just get me out of here as quick as you can.
Yeah, that's one of the few things in life that I consistently just can't stand is getting a haircut. I had a haircut scheduled earlier in the week, and then I got busy and canceled it.
Were you so busy doing your presentation on screen time?
It was something. That was part of it, yeah.
I heard that was a great success, and if you're listening to us now on the podcast, you can go back. We just released it as a bonus episode. An hour and 20 minutes
I didn't
of
know
Matt.
That.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a lot of Matt.
Well, how was it?
It was a lot of fun. We had a great turnout. KSL put on a presentation. It was about anxiety, depression, suicide, and we weaved some screen time talk in there.
And you got all
had
that done in an hour and 20 minutes?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, and we did a big Q&A at the end. I don't know if that's in the bonus episode.
It is, and you can also see it on our Facebook page, on the Project Recovery Facebook page. And the thing, because I watched it.
Yeah?
I watched it, and you did a great job.
I saved you a seat, you know.
Yeah, I know. but I watched it, and the thing I liked, they said they were trying to wrap it up, and there was five people in the queue waiting to ask a question, and Dr. Matt said, nope, we'll make sure everyone's questions are answered.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty cool of you.
Oh, well, I wanted to make sure everybody had a chance to talk. I wasn't in a hurry to go anywhere, so.
But I like the fact that people came loaded with questions.
They had great questions, a lot of audience participation. It was a lot of fun. I hope we can do another one sometime.
You betcha. And so I've got some big news.
Yeah, what's that?
Do you want to guess?
I think it's that shirt. You're looking really cool today.
You want to know the story behind the shirt?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. So I had to go help my girlfriend's daughter jump her car at Fremont High School the other day.
All right.
And since I'm up in Ogden because I got to blow twice a day for the 24/7 program.
Yeah, explain that. Please.
I was gonna stay up there that night, and I forgot to bring a shirt. So this is my girlfriend's son's shirt.
Is it really? Yeah. No wonder you're looking so cool.
I was like, I need to borrow one of your son's shirts. And she
All
goes,
right.
You can have this one. And I go, he doesn't want it. And she goes, nope. And
so that's a cool looking
yeah,
shirt.
Yeah, right?
RVCA?
Ruka.
Ruka.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how to say it.
That's how you say
I'm not
it.
Cool like the
young
cool
kids.
Are
saying that. Yeah. So that the shirt's not the new news.
Oh, okay. But you do look really young.
Yeah,
today.
Okay. Well, thank you. So let's play a game in here.
All right.
Everybody raise your hand if you're employed.
Yeah.
I got a job.
Right. Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm a recovery specialist with Pinnacle Recovery Center.
Nice. Very good.
So what that really means is I'm out and about talking about what I do here, talk about Pinnacle Recovery Center and what they offer. And so
You go where? Where do you go?
So I go to detox centers. Mm-hmm. I go to other recovery centers. Mm-hmm. Because like we've talked about with recovery centers, you know, you really owe it to yourself and your family members and your loved ones to find the recovery center that mm-hmm. best fits your needs, best fits your vibe, best fits your way of thinking. And so we go and talk to all the other recovery centers. And so if somebody comes to Pinnacle Recovery Center and they want help, and I go, okay, but this is kind of what we're doing, and it doesn't align with their beliefs or their thoughts, we'll go, well, maybe this one's more your speed.
Oh, okay. So instead of just trying to make them fit into your model,
yeah.
you're aware of lots of different models that
yeah.
are out there.
I mean, because there's all kinds of different people out there in different addictions, and you know, and so we just try to find the best fit for that person. So it's a very close-knit group, I guess. And
yeah,
so
I
this morning I spent some time up at Brighton Recovery in Ogden
okay.
and just got to know everybody up there. And they started out when you're all in a circle and they're like, okay, so say who you are, say how long you've been with the company. And I was the very last one. And I was like, my name's Casey. This is my third day.
Nice.
How are you guys?
Yeah.
Thanks for the breakfast. And I mean, so I'm really excited because I think one of the best things you can do for your recovery is service and giving back.
You bet.
And I'm passionate about it. I know the program. I'm an alumni of the program. And so.
And you're pretty good at talking.
I love to talk.
Yeah. And pretty good at that.
That's what I do.
Well, I'm really glad for you because it's been a long year of, bumming rides. So thank goodness that's over.
I've been DJing.
A lot of Uber bills, a lot of DJing gigs. I know you've been wanting. And, you know, I was talking to somebody the other day. Somebody asked me, one of my colleagues at work actually asked me because they've been following your story. How is it that he is working? And I said, well, that's actually been a really hard thing. He isn't working. We talked about how often things that come with getting a DUI or whatever stop you from progressing in your recovery.
The ramifications.
The ramifications. And some people seem to have very little empathy for that until you explain to them, like, listen, for somebody who can't drive in our culture here, in our society, you are very limited on where you can go to get treatment.
You're handcuffed to your house.
Where you can go to work. And if you can't work, then you're much more likely to relapse. When the pressures are up in life, then your relapse rate is much higher. And so I'm so glad to hear that you have that job. That's awesome, man.
You know,
and you're the great, and we were talking about the program in Weber County 24/7, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's a no-brainer. I can't believe that isn't everywhere.
Well, I think they're trying to implement it.
I hope so.
And so I think what they're doing is seeing how this works and seeing how the success is. And so right now, I'm pleased as punch. The people probably look at me weird because I'm whistling going into a jail twice a day. You know, I'm like, hey, you know, I'm just going, hey, what's up? How are you doing? You know?
But like that whole, like that means freedom, that you can go in there and blow and then leave.
Yeah.
I just can't stop laughing.
And so every time I'm driving in my car because I've got an interlock device on the car, you know, every once in a while it goes off and you have to breathe into it. Mm-hmm. And my son, my 8-year-old, goes, what's that? And I go, if I don't blow into this, the world's going to blow up, son. He goes, blow, Dad, blow! I'm got this.
So, all right. Way to create anxiety disorders in your kid. Good job.
Wow, I didn't think of it that way. I thought I was being funny.
Fear is funny.
Yeah. Hey, so Project Recovery is continuing to share great stories, and that's what we really like. And last week was a very informative one. We talked about preventative maintenance. We talked about education, and there's some great groups out there.
There really are.
And probably a month ago, I was doing a presentation at the We Are One Recovery Expo up in Ogden, and I got a chance to hear this young lady's story. And afterwards, she came up to me and she goes, hey, I'd love to be on
it. Makes you sound really old when you say this young lady.
Okay, how old are you?
I'm older than you.
47.
I'm 47.
I'm 45.
I'm just saying.
Lizzie, how old are you?
30.
I know. I know she's young and we're old, but
I'm wearing the hip shirt.
Yeah, you do look cool today. I'll have to give that
to you. Okay, thanks. Yeah. But Lizzie has an amazing story. So not only are we going to hear her story, we're going to hear from her husband, Brian. He's here as well. But just, you know, because we run an honest program.
Right.
Lizzie, I had the biggest crush on your sister, Emily, all through high school. She was a tigerette. She was cool. She was so much fun, and she was just the coolest chick ever. So how's Emily doing?
So good.
All right.
She still is all of those things.
Isn't
except
she?
For a tigerette.
No, she's not a tigerette. But she kind of ran the tigerettes for a while, didn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was the coach after for, I think, a year.
And you were a cheerleader at Ogden High.
Mm-hmm.
Go Ogden.
Wow.
Ogden High School football rules.
Yes, it does.
Well,
I don't know about the football. They had some hard years.
We had some rough years. But do we have the horse?
They're getting better.
Yeah,
we got the horse. That's all that matters. That's our rivalry between Ben Lomond High School and Ogden High School. It's called the Iron Horse.
Oh, the Iron Horse.
Yeah.
It's actually a train.
It's a train. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Gotcha.
But they call it a horse.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Yeah. So, Lizzie, let's hear about your story.
Okay, where should I start? Like all the way back?
Yeah,
why not? Tell us where you're from.
I'm from Mountain Green. I grew up in Ogden.
There we
go.
Yeah. Yeah, she's a Morganite, but you grew up in Ogden.
Yes, I grew up in Ogden, like you said, Emily, my sister, and then I'm the youngest of six. And I grew up really normal, very normal childhood, nothing.
No trauma.
No trauma, no abuse, no nothing that I can pinpoint that would have caused any sort of imbalance. I was very physically active. I played soccer, I ran track, I ran cross country, and then I was a cheerleader. So that was a big bulk of my high school. I was, it's kind of funny to watch Emily's daughter, Annie, now because I can see myself in her. I was very OCD about my grades. 4.0, nothing less was acceptable. And I always wanted to be, like, I always wanted to start on the soccer team. I didn't want to be, like, second string. I always...
So you had high standards for yourself.
Very high standards. But nobody put those on me. My parents didn't.
Self-imposed.
Yeah. My parents weren't like, if you don't get a 4.0, you don't get a car. Or, like, I got a job at 16, and my parents were well off. I didn't have to get a job. I just always was very driven. Kind of just.
I want a daughter like Lizzie. I mean, I got great daughters.
Yeah.
Lizzie's setting the bar high.
Yeah. Some kids really, I mean, we're all born with certain tendencies, and some people have that drive to achieve. You know, they're very, like you're saying, very active, a lot of different interests, want to be good at the things you try. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very competitive.
Yep.
Mostly with myself, with that. But very competitive. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That carried on to college. I did 1 year of like getting all of the things to qualify for nursing school.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so then I went to Weber
Prerequisites.
State. Prerequisites. Yes, thank you. Oh, my goodness. I went to Weber State's nursing program. And,
which is tough to get into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I got in my first time, which was exciting. And after about my first year in nursing school, I met Brian. And we've been married for 9 years now. And I worked at McKady Hospital on the pediatric unit and the step-down ICU unit for 8 years. But before that, I left McKay when I had my daughter. So we had some infertility problems, which was really hard, especially for my high standards. I feel like everything should like be able to make sense. So any bumps in the road, I really struggled with, and infertility was definitely one of those things. And so we did infertility treatments. We had our daughter, I think it was like a couple years after trying. And
that can put a stress on a relationship.
Yeah, for sure. It's also, it sounds like, you know, to draw the attention to the difference on that versus the other things, you know, whether it's grades or sports or, you know, getting accepted to the nursing program, those were all things you had some fairly large element of control over. If you studied hard, if you worked hard, you could guarantee outcomes. And so, when you hit a roadblock in life that you don't have control over, like fertility, then that's extra frustrating for high achieving people, because you're like, hey, all the skills and tools that I use to be successful in every other area of my life don't apply here because I can't just study harder and get pregnant or, you know, like it's a biological issue. And that must have been, how would you describe that feeling of being out of control or being unable to fix it?
I was so defeated. I feel like it was kind of like the center of every emotion, every conversation that we would have with friends, with family, with between us. It caused so much tension that I just felt like kind of like a failure, in the sense of like, I can't do the one thing that I'm here to do.
And isn't that strange to feel like a failure, yet, you know, it's something you didn't really have control over,
right? Yeah.
But because you're used to being able to achieve, work hard, create the outcomes you want for yourself, you're right. People, when they hit a health crisis like that, feel like a failure. Like, I'm not good enough. I didn't work hard enough.
Yeah.
But of course, rationally, that doesn't apply. But emotionally,
yeah,
it really gets you down.
Hey, you're listening to Project Recovery. More with Brian and Lizzie coming up.
Hey, Casey Scott here, and I'm happy to say our podcast, Project Recovery, is sponsored by Reprieve Recovery. Reprieve is a women's only center located in Mountain Green, Utah. Find out more on their website at ReprieveRC.com.
And I was feeling left behind because I'm so competitive in this, that sense of everything is, I would look at my friends having kids and I'm like, no. You can't have another baby. I haven't had mine yet, you know? So, jealousy.
You should have like 12 now just to show them up.
Nope. We have two and we're good, which is now funny because I was so desperate. But so after I had her.
And about how old were you at that time?
25. Yeah. So I had her and I was planning on staying home with her. And thank goodness, because Brian is an engineer, so he has given me that opportunity and I love it. And I was so excited to be a stay-at-home mom and I was going to do it just perfect because, you know, that perfectionism.
At least better than your friends, right?
Yeah, right. Better than anyone because I, yeah. And I'm the youngest of six, so I have like all these nieces and nephews that I've helped raise. Like I would, Emily's kids, my sister, I had them all the time and I feel like they're part of mine. Me and I knew how to do it and it was going to be so easy. And it was probably I always say 2 to 3 weeks. I don't know exactly when it set in. I know I felt not great in the hospital, but I didn't feel great in the hospital with my son who I had 5 months ago. So once I got home, I felt better. But 3 weeks later, I just like didn't want to get out of bed.
So 3 weeks after delivering your first child.
Yeah, my daughter. Yeah.
So is that postpartum?
Mm-hmm. Bad. Like, I've never felt depression. I've never felt really anxiety other than everybody who feels anxiety every day, normal anxiety. And I just felt so alone and isolated. And it was going from working at the hospital, tons of people around me all day, and so many, like, intellectual conversations, and I was pushing my brain, and to go from that to staying home all day with a newborn, and you know newborns, they just blankly stare into your eyes and you don't even know, there's like no emotion behind it. So the only connection really that I had was when Brian would get home from work, and that was solely to do with the fact that I was isolating. I was just wanting to stay home and have everyone go away. That was my biggest thing, is that I had my daughter and that's all I wanted. And the other part of it too, the more that I've processed through that part of my life, was I didn't want people to see that I was failing with myself. Like, I didn't want people to see, we were talking earlier before we started, is that I was the life of the party, kind of. Like, I have that very bubbly, talkative personality. I love to connect. I love to...
You didn't want anyone to see you this way.
I didn't want anyone to see me, yeah.
It was behind the curtain, like a Wizard of Oz. It's like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to keep it to myself, and I wanted to wait until it went away and then show that, see, I'm fine, and everything's great.
So were you savvy enough with your RN degree to know that you were suffering postpartum?
I would say I fully admitted that, like, a month and a half after having her, yeah. Yeah.
And but so who do you...
It took a while for you to recognize the signs or what?
Yeah, I think I was really trying for it to be postpartum blues, not depression. Because I know everybody... I've seen a lot of people go through the early parts of motherhood and the sleep deprivation and how hard and new it is that I'm like, I'm just adjusting. Like, I'll just get used to this and then I'll be fine and I'll snap out of it. I think once I knew I was depressed was once I had run out of my pain prescription that I was numbing the depression with, and then I didn't have anything for like a week. I knew I was depressed. I just, yeah.
So you were taking the pain pills, the prescription that you got just for a normal pregnancy?
So I took it in the hospital for normal pregnancy, and then I had some epidural pain that I took it for like on and off for like a week after I got home, but... It was about 3 weeks after I took it, and this was once I knew, like, once the depression had set in, and I took that first one, and it was like the world changed. It was like I could see color. I wanted to go out on a walk. I called my mom and talked to her forever. I went grocery shopping. I got ready, which was like a huge thing. I was just barely doing the bare minimum, taking a shower every day.
So essentially you felt like you got your life back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my normal, which was what I was waiting for. So all of a sudden I felt normal with this in my system. And it was opiate pain. I don't know which one it was, but some kind of opiate. Yeah.
And so how long did you keep that going for?
So I ran out of that first one and we just went back to my OB and he gave me more. And then I went back again to him and he didn't. So then I went to my primary care physician and I probably went to him. I'd probably like five. My daughter was probably 5 months.
How did your OB handle that conversation when you went back the second time? Did you ask for more?
It's interesting. It's very interesting because he had a tear and I had fallen down the stairs, so it was like just whatever. I had like acute pain that I could describe, so he didn't question it really.
So, but why didn't he send you with a prescription that second time?
The second time that I went back, he just said we don't do that. It was kind of just like a hard line.
Okay.
Which now he was my doctor for my son, who I had 5 months ago, and he's like on the opioid board and
like task force.
He's very involved with it. And so when I first went in for my first appointment, I'm like, I want no pain medicine. Like I was barely pregnant. He's like, okay, that's like way down the road. But I'm like, I want no pain medicine. I don't want it ever offered. This is the line. And then he told me that. And I'm like, that's so interesting. And he's like, I failed a lot of patients. That's something he said. And I didn't tell him. Obviously, I'm not going to say that. But I did say I got addicted to him after having my daughter. And it's so scary.
Well, I think one of the things that's great about having you on the show is you can speak to it from a medical point of view, being, you know, a nurse and having your own experience as a patient.
Yeah.
And we've talked with lots of people. I mean, we haven't really hammered too deeply and gotten into the cultural change that's happening in medicine, but that's a new thing to have doctors on the board of something like an opiate task force, because as little as 10 years ago, doctors, that was just kind of the standard practice, was to give out without questioning a lot or thinking about addiction.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to say that doctors have never thought about that, of course, but the culture is changing.
Yeah.
And it's because, you know, certain physicians and nurses have gotten involved with that, with things like task force and changing policies. And so I'm glad to hear that 5 years ago he said, we just don't do that.
And it's just crazy, too, that just within 5 years that change.
It's been a really short period of time that this change has happened, but it's spreading quickly.
Yeah, it was amazing to me.
So you go to the OB, he draws a hard line. And so then you go, well, I got to get some. And you go to your primary care physician.
And he gave it out. There was really no problem there. But what the problem for me was, I started to get panicky and already very deceitful and not wanting Brian to find out. So I started to, like, rummage through medicine cabinets at friends' houses. And, like, if my mom wasn't home or, well, I guess I never did from her. But, like, if I knew somebody was going to be gone, I'd say, can I borrow something, go in their house, take some of their pills? And yeah, I started to do that on top of getting prescriptions. So it wasn't like overly getting prescribed. Like I didn't want Brian to think, whoa, this is a problem. And I told him I was just getting it for headaches. And then from all these other people, it was like, I know how to like fill in the gaps from stealing from friends and family.
No, your addiction gives you a lesson on how to do that.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, because it's fight or flight. I mean,
and you can't go without.
Yeah.
And so you always have
enough. That's not an
option. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to, if it's okay, challenge you a little bit. Uh-oh. So you're a nurse. You're, you know, 6 weeks out at this point and realize I don't just have postpartum blues. I really feel this postpartum depression. And I'm taking opiates and I feel the benefit, temporary, obviously, of those for my depression. Why not seek real medical treatment for your depression?
I did.
Okay.
Tell
us about that.
Yeah. So when I went to him, I said, I have these headaches. That's why to get the pain medicine. But I'm like, but I think I'm depressed. And I felt like this since I've had my baby. And so he tried three different antidepressants. And I just didn't trust the process, even though I know the six weeks to be fully kicked in. And I never went off the pain medicine to allow my body to like rid that euphoria and that change in my brain to allow the antidepressants to do what they're supposed to do, right. I would just say in like a week, oh, they're not working, and stop taking them.
And that's interesting because you knew, you're talking about SSRI, serotonin specific reuptake inhibitors. You're talking about, we know that it's, you know, about 6 weeks before we see maximum benefit from those medicines. Yet you didn't want to wait that long. You'd go a week or two, and that's what my patients do. They'll come back. That doesn't work, right? So was that to maintain? Do you think that was part your subconscious mind? I want to maintain the addiction. I don't want to.
Definitely
I
the addict brain.
I don't want Prozac to work, so I'm going to stop it early.
Yeah, I definitely liked the way pain medicine made me feel. Yeah. That's 100% true. It was so immediate that I could be a good mom in 30 minutes versus six weeks from now.
Yeah.
But also, I still kind of had that chip on my shoulder that I don't get depression.
Yeah.
Because I'm me.
I wondered about that.
Yeah. I'm very much so that, like, that competitive thing, like, they're not working because I don't
You know,
have
I was
it.
Thinking about this because I know people have said this about me and my addiction to my family. And I know people say it. And I think what we've learned about addiction is it doesn't discriminate.
Yeah.
But for the longest time, people thought, oh, like that happened to him. He comes from such a good family.
Right.
Or, you know, I can't believe that happened to him. You
exactly.
know, he seems like they come from such good stock, you know.
As if somehow you guys are messing around in something you shouldn't. Or,
yeah. Why did it happen to him?
Right.
And, the reality is it can happen to all of us.
Mm-hmm. And that's on an addiction conversation. It's also on the broader spectrum of mental health.
Yeah.
You know, and so people say the same things about an anxiety disorder or depression, like, oh, well, what happened? What's wrong with them? I thought they had a nice family, you know? Things like that. And interestingly enough, and I don't mean to derail your story too much, but I think there's a parallel here between your postpartum depression, obviously, and your addiction development. But as over the last 5 or 6 years, we've had a huge public awareness and research in the opiates addiction problem. There's also a ton of research going on in postpartum issues with not just postpartum depression, but we now have identified something called postpartum psychosis. And a lot of women really have struggled in silence, feeling like postpartum, oh, it's not a real thing. Many women will have postpartum blues. And so often women are not very supportive of each other. Oh, well, I got over mine. Mm-hmm. Just in a couple of weeks, I felt fine. And other women will feel a lot of guilt. Well, I have this beautiful baby here, and I get to stay home. Why am I not happy? And so they don't want to admit it to anyone. They don't want to talk to anyone about it. And so addictions can start in that time. I'm glad you brought it up to your physician, because women I've spoken to have even not wanted to, because, you know, you come in with the new baby for a well check and the doctor's like, oh, what a cute baby, it must be great, and you don't want to admit that you are severely depressed
and the guilt of infertility.
Yeah,
this is what I wanted,
right?
Why am I not happy? Yeah, it was so crazy.
So how long do you think, how long were you in your active addiction?
Okay, so if I can kind of, I'll speed this up because you just mentioned something that I think is the culture of this doesn't happen in these certain families, bringing that up. So I went, my daughter was 9 months when I started treatment the first time. So I went through Action Recovery Group in South Ogden, where I work now, for 28 days. And I got out, got into their continuing care program, and I immediately got a job, which was not great because I was around pain pills and I was only 30 days clean. So I was doing like a home health type job, and I ended up taking some from one of the patients, and it was this whole thing. And like I got reprimanded, and then I kind of was honest. And so she was like, it was just like this gray area. And then I, figured out that the way that the home health system worked, you can like the way that opiate prescriptions are now, you have to like go in, pick it up from the doctor, then go fill it, you know, physically. But with home health, you could do like this weird faxing thing. So I did that, and I had already relapsed. Totally faking it. He was coming to continuing care with me. Everything was great. Like, I was clean. Life was great.
But you were living a lie.
Living a lie. Yep. I had not closed that back door of not ever being around pain pills, which is sealed shut now. I just didn't realize that was such a big thing for me. I'm like, I can be around them, definitely.
I did 28 days. I'm fixed.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
And I know what I did wrong. I think there's a lot of people who do that, and that's what goes to a relapse, is they think they've got the education and they got the knowledge. And they go, oh, I can. Yeah, I'm good now.
Yeah. Education's the first step, but it's not sufficient to keep people sober.
Education is just not enough.
Right.
I mean, there's
got to
be actions.
Yep.
And you're not unique. That's the thing, is I felt so, like, once again, I'm competitive. I'm the best. I've got this figured out in 28 days, and so I'm unique. I can be around them. I know all of these other people can't, and they have to shut all their back doors, but I don't have to because I'm better, which is horrible. But anyway, so I actually got arrested because of the prescription fraud.
Prescription fraud. So you did eventually get caught and arrested, huh?
Yeah.
What was that like? Where were you when you got arrested?
I've been arrested.
That was Knuckles between Casey and I.
A little bones there.
It's like the worst Knuckles to give.
And I say that because I know the pressure I put on myself and my family about that. And I'm forever sorry. But it was a reality that happened, and I can't go back and change it. All I can do is move forward and do my best to every day.
Hey, Casey Scott here, and I'm happy to say our podcast, Project Recovery, is sponsored by Reprieve Recovery. Reprieve is a women's only center located in Mountain Green, Utah. Find out more on their website at ReprieveRC.com.
Yeah. You know, but when that happened, I bet, what were your thoughts?
Gosh. So I am a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I was serving in the Young Women's Presidency. I had just barely gotten released. He was the Young Men's President. It was a Sunday. I had one of my, quote, headaches. So I was home, really just not wanting to go to church because I was living a lie going. And a detective called me and said he wanted to meet with me about whatever. And I was like, oh, okay. That's great, whatever. And so I went. This was on a Sunday, so it was super weird. The whole thing was so weird.
Called me to come to the station,
yeah. And so I went in with my daughter.
What were you thinking? Like, what were you thinking about why you were going?
Well, I'm unique. I can get away with anything.
I'll talk my way out of this.
Look at my charm. Yeah, I can smile and skip by. Like, I got through treatment in 28 days, and I can do that again and just talk my way. I mean, he knows better than anyone. I manipulated the crap out of him. But I went in, and it was just in this little room, and he was just talking to me. And then he showed me, like, the facts thing for the prescription fraud. And I was like, my heart just sunk. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to go to court and all this stuff. And I almost felt like that it was fine because I had my daughter with me. But they were like, we're arresting you. And I was like, right now? I just remember feeling so much like I was different than other people. Like, he's not going to arrest me. I have my daughter. So he got a call at church. Just like horrible. Had to come down.
He's your husband. This,
my husband, Brian. Sorry, Brian, yeah.
And we're going to hear from Brian in just a second.
He got a call, and yeah, he came down and he picked my daughter up. And yeah, I went to jail for 6 days. It was like, I think that's when, like, the reality of all of it set in. And it was almost kind of like, this is crazy to say, but I almost was like, okay, everyone knows my life. I mean, I did feel like my life is ruined. I actually wrote about this in a meditation the other day, was all of our titles that we give ourselves. And I think a big thing for me was I like to not label, but title myself. And my best friend and I were talking about the fact that I still call myself an addict, and to label yourself. Her husband has a hard time with being like labeled forever as like that I label myself forever as an addict. And I'm thinking of that and I'm like, I label myself as a mother, a friend, a wife, a four sport athlete. Like I've labeled myself this whole time, my whole life as these titles. And I just remember being in that jail cell and being like, all of my titles are ripped from me because I've ruined everything. Like my whole life is over. It was very, very humbling.
Mine was drunk. That was the title that I gave myself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one that wiped away all of the stuff that I've done prior.
Yeah.
Was drunk. Mm-hmm. And I think through recovery, you learn that it doesn't wipe those things away.
Yeah.
You still are a mother. You still are an athlete.
Yeah.
You're still all those things. But that one was right in front of your face.
Yeah.
And you had to deal with it.
Yeah.
And so there you are in jail for 6 days, thinking your whole world came to an end.
Yeah.
For many, we talk about a rock bottom on this podcast. Is that your rock bottom?
Definitely. I think that definitely was the moment within that first week, because in jail, I made a suicide plan. So my rock bottom was incorporated with that. I did get out and I knew I was going to go home to my house, and I knew that my husband wouldn't let me have my daughter. And so I knew she would be his mom's or my mom's or whatever, and I'd be home. And so I had it all planned out that I was going to just get in the tub and take the gun so it wouldn't be super messy. There's the perfectionism coming in, so somebody wouldn't have to like clean up a huge mess. And the next day, once he went to work, that I would kill myself. And the God's hand in that was him saying, "You're not coming home. You're going wherever you're going to go, but you're not coming home." So I went to my mom's. Didn't have access to that, and I ended up having a meeting with my counselor, Rick, at Action Recovery Group that very next day, and which was a conversation that saved my life for sure. It was just me saying, "I'm ruined. All of this is ruined." And that's when we had a big conversation. I had a big conversation with Rick about closing all the back doors, those back doors that I was telling you about. That
I'm going to let you catch your breath here for
good.
1 second, because I want to bring you and Brian.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you let her home?
Oh, man. Where does the list begin? It was just constant fighting. It was constant lying. And she said constant manipulating. It was every time we were around, I was always suspecting her being high. Like, okay, you're high. Where are you getting pills from? Where are you hiding them? Where are they? How dare you? You know, it was constantly. So when she got arrested, my phone kept ringing, answered it. It's like, "Hey, it's the police. We've got your daughter. You need to come pick her up." I'm just like, oh. And I was kind of relieved. I'm like, good. Because something had to happen. Because the way we were going, we were done. Like, I was just done with this. It felt like my life was ruined. I was just constantly having to babysit two kids, like her and my daughter. And I didn't trust her with my daughter while I was at work, because who knows what was going on. And so when that finally happened and I went and picked her up, the cop was talking to me, and he's like, "Well, we think we have enough evidence that we're gonna arrest her." So I'm like, good. I'm like, "You should." I told him you should test her for this is what she's been stealing. I've been getting phone calls from family, friends, and nothing. It's just out of control. So when she got out, I was super bitter, super mad. I'm just like, "You got what you deserve. Now you can't come home. Don't bother us. Like, go figure your life out."
Sounds like they started to return an element of control to your life.
Yeah, it felt exactly. I had zero control. This was my life was spiraling out of control for a decision I never made, which I had a really hard time coming to grips with. Mm-hmm. I'm doing everything right. I'm trying to be the best person I can be, and she's off doing what she wants to do, and it was directly affecting me, and it killed me.
It's interesting, Casey, to see the comparison between both of them telling that version of the story, right? So you were doing your thing and using and trying to feel like I can stay on top of this and I can keep things under control, while at the same time it sounds like you were frantically running around feeling more and more like things were spiraling out of control. And when that day came of the arrest, you know, it sent you to a reality, which we'll talk about in a second, which is common for perfectionist thinkers, but it started to ground you a little bit more, didn't it, Brian? Gave you kind of a return of like, you know, I think a lot of listeners might say, oh, that sounds uncaring that he was saying, good, arrest her. But that was the stabilization you needed to be able to take care of your family, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it wasn't the first time. I've called the cops on her.
Oh, let's hear that.
I was
But on the same thing, I was very empathetic towards Lizzie because I've been where she is.
Well, yeah.
And I mean, I started to get teary-eyed when she told that story.
Of
because
course.
I've been desperate. I've been down. The jig is up. I've been to that point. And I go, right. And when she says she felt that relief, there's like, whew,
yeah.
I had that release. And it was, and I was like,
sure.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, I think it's empathy for both people. That's what's so great about having the two of you come on as a couple and talk about both of your experiences with this. And you're both going through it, but having very different experiences, both difficult, and we can have empathy for both.
Same story.
What you're both going through.
Yeah.
I think, you know, for a perfectionist person, a very competitive person, when you finally hit that wall, one of the negatives, being a competitive person is a cool thing. Those are the people that like entertain us, that make things happen in this world, that make the achievements, you know, they're fun. But every positive quality we have can have a negative side effect. And the negative side effect is all or nothing thinking, black and white, all or nothing. So you're such a well-accomplished, great person, and you're doing well. You have a good marriage, all these things. But because you got arrested, then you went straight to this nothing. Now I'm nothing. Now I have
so
nothing.
True.
Creates kind of a hopelessness. And hopelessness is kind of that route to suicidal thinking.
Mm-hmm.
If it can't get better, then I ought to check out. And there's so many people will be relating to this story of yours because listening to this story, because so many people have been there where you finally feel hopeless and you start to wonder, how can I escape this?
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting you say hope, because I think it was 2 weeks after I got out and I had met with my counselor. He had met with my counsel, we met with him together, and then we made like these pros and cons list. Like we were doing all these things, and we still felt like we were kind of underwater. And
what
so,
what were the pros and cons for? For keeping the marriage,
going to like a residential treatment or center, or going back to Action Recovery as an intensive outpatient program, doing individual therapy versus a group therapy. Just kind of like pros and cons of that, like how we were gonna, if we were gonna try to make this work, and. I just said to him, I think we need to like go to a meeting. So we went to the Church of Jesus Christ Latter-day Saints 12-step meeting. And so interesting, because it was hope. It was step two. And I just remember that whole time we were like, got back in the car and we were like, we lost hope. That's our problem. We lost hope and faith in something greater than us that can pull us out. And I think that he should share this, but he got an answer to his prayer after that. I don't know. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure.
After the hope meeting.
And I fought her, like going to a meeting. I'm like, what's the point? It's just going to waste our time. You're going to keep using. So I went in with a very bad attitude.
Hopeless,
bad, all around. So we went to the meeting, and it was really good. And it was the first time that I myself had ever been to any kind of a group therapy meeting, if you will. And it was really awesome to be around other people, to hear success stories. And that's immediately like that gave me hope. So in the prior to this, I mean, it was almost like what you were referring to. Pros and cons of staying married. Like that was constantly on my mind. Like, I don't see this working out. She's just going to be her and I can't live like this anymore. And so I prayed harder than I probably ever had in my life. What do I do? I pride myself on being like a good person and knowing what's right. And I legitimately was just like frozen in place. I did not know what to do. And it came to me that I just randomly just started reading. And I think it was the news, like on Yahoo or something. And something came up, some study about divorce and the effects it has on family and individuals and whatever. And immediately I just got the feeling like, okay, we're going to work this out. She is my wife. I loved her to death. When we first met, we've got to work this out. I know she's in there somewhere. And I know it's a bad thing to say that the addict changes the person, but it really truly did.
Yeah.
She was not my wife that I married in her active addiction. And so I just made that decision. And that was probably my very first step in actually moving into recovery, was saying, okay, I made a decision. I'm staying with you. So now what? And that's, I still don't feel like I'm a person to talk to about this. I feel like I'm totally clueless. I just totally winged it. And now we're here. But
no, but that's when we got involved.
Something to be said for doing some soul searching, whether it's praying or meditating on issues, and following the intuition that you have. It takes courage to follow one's intuition, and I think what you're describing is that, you know, it all came together as you read that article, and you had a moment of clarity, an epiphany, an answer to prayer, whatever you want to refer to it as, and you followed that. And I think that's part of most people's success story in life, is being grounded and searching for answers and then having the courage to follow the intuition that comes.
Yeah.
And when you said you don't feel like you're somebody should be talking, you're definitely somebody should be talking, because I think a lot of marriages don't survive an addiction. And the fact that you guys have figured out what works for you guys is giving others out there hope. But you said something, Lizzie, that I think is a key to why it is working. You said that's when he got involved.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying when you're in your addiction that the other spouse is not involved, but I don't think that they're on the same page, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think we've learned by interviewing people and talking to people in my practice, the spouse who doesn't have the addiction has a different problem with the addiction.
Yeah.
And so when you went to, I could just tell by you telling the story, Brian, when Lizzie went to jail, there was a sense of relief. Yeah. Like you were getting a break from the stress of the addiction, the way it was affecting you. And so it's a lot to be able to say, okay, I'm back in this. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna help you with it.
Yeah. Well, when we met with the counselor, Rick, after I had gotten out of jail, he said, "This is the problem. If she goes back into recovery and she takes this on, she's going to only go up. She's going to continually work on herself, and she's only going to improve. And this is she's going to go up and away from you. The problem is that he didn't like reprimand him by any means, because like he wasn't doing anything wrong, but the way that we could make it work, and the fact that he had chosen to stay after, you know, everyone in the world telling him to get a divorce, the only way he was going to be able to cling to the marriage and that it really would be fueled and work was if he worked on himself. So instead of me growing away and up and him staying stagnant, it was he embraced recovery. He started to come to continuing care with me and began to learn about himself. And it wasn't, when I say he got involved, he got involved. He worked the 12 steps. He went to meetings, and he didn't go to the meetings with me. He went to the recovery support meetings,
family support group
for the church's program. And it's kind of like the Al-Anon for AA, but yeah, he's a facilitator in that program. And it was like, once that happened, it was something clicked. The whole world kind of fell away from us, and we were us. We kind of had to choose recovery and each other, and then everything else will work out how it's going to.
Sounds like maybe your friends and family all had opinions about what you should be doing.
Oh, yeah. I got opinions everywhere, and unsolicited opinions. It was.
Those are the best kind.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. At first,
you know what you should do.
Yeah, exactly.
But at first, you loved it because everybody was on your team.
No, I never did love it.
Oh.
I would get invited to family dinner or something, and while she was in jail. Like, hey, let's go out to dinner. And then it's the last thing I want to talk about is my effed up life. I just want to go and just relax. And it's like, this is what you need to do. So-and-so knew so-and-so, and this is what happened. You need to do this.
Divorce attorneys.
It was just constant. It wasn't even just divorce. It was just, this is what's going to happen, guaranteed. You know,
she'll never get better.
Yeah.
That was the constant. Yeah. There was no hope.
Why do you think these are people that loved you.
Yeah.
And I assume loved Lizzie.
Mm-hmm.
That seems pretty dire advice.
It is. And I think.
Where does that come from?
Well, it came from both of our families. Her family even gave me advice. She has a sister who is currently in the addiction realm.
She's 2 years older.
2 years older than her.
Meth.
Yeah. Everything. Just got out of prison not too long ago. So her family had already been through this. And they're like, you know what?
And that was their end result, was my sister.
Who yeah. Never
been
got
in and out of jail since 18, you know?
Okay. Yeah. So it was.
I think sometimes, I guess what I'm hinting at is sometimes that really harsh advice, get a divorce, you know, she'll never get better. It actually comes from a place of both love and fear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
oh, yeah.
They see like, let's try to salvage what we can here. Mm-hmm. You've got kids to take care of and you know, or one kid at the time. I think looking back on it, we can kind of have a little empathy for family too. They probably look at how the two of you are doing now and are very glad you didn't take their advice.
Hey, you're listening to Project Recovery. More with Brian and Lizzie coming up.
Has anyone admitted that?
Yes, actually. So, funny story is because of once I made that decision, I'm like, you know what, guys, just stop. We're going to work this out. Either way, I'm trying to work this out. This is my decision. And then it came to the point of, okay, well, if you're doing that, then don't come around. We don't want you. We don't want Lizzie around family.
Okay.
So if my family's listening to this, sorry, but this is what you guys did. And so it was really hard. So it's
we run an honest program, right?
Yeah. And it was.
But it turned out.
Yeah, and I'll get to that. Okay. I mean, it was brutal. Sorry. It would be like birthday parties, and I would see it like on Instagram or something. I'm like, oh. We didn't get invited, or family parties, or whatever.
That is pretty tough.
And it was like, well, why am I getting punished for this, you know? And then slowly they came around. But
that will go back to what we've been taught in recovery is boundaries. And if that's their parents' boundaries, that's their parents' boundaries. And if they don't want to invite that in right now, that's their thing.
You have to learn to respect
that. You have to learn to respect it. You might not agree with it.
Right.
But
it's hurtful sometimes.
Yeah, hurtful, but you don't know what they're going through. And, you know, exactly. Like your parents of what they've seen mm-hmm. through. And so they're just kind of doing what they've known and what they've been taught and what they've learned through others. And so they're doing self-preservation as well, I would think.
Yeah, best they can do, yeah.
You know, and I think that's what we're all doing is the best we can do with what we do. So you guys decide you're going to do it together.
Yeah.
What does that look like?
So the first thing we started doing, it was the meetings. That was like the first step, and I really enjoyed it. I was like, that was one of the coolest things I've ever been to. Like, such awesome people, such diversity, and everybody has a commonality. And it was just, you immediately felt like, I am best friends with every person in here, and I don't know one person's name.
Kind of like what you were saying.
Yeah.
You walk into a room, and then all of a sudden you feel like, oh, my gosh, I'm not so out of this world.
I hope the listeners are really taking that in, because you know what? That's not how most people think of a meeting for recovery, right? If you've never been to one, a lot of people feel like it's going to be a bunch of
sad sacks who can't figure it out.
Exactly. And why would I want to be part of that?
Yeah.
But you actually look like he's smiling when he's telling the story about like how fun it was to go to the recovery meeting.
They were, and we loved them. And that's like, it turned into a date night, as horrible as that sounds. Like, it would be like Thursday, Friday night, whatever the home group was we were going to. We get a babysitter to come over, and we're like, okay, we're going to dinner and a meeting. And we did it. And we did that for like a year and a half, 2 years?
2 years, yeah.
Every single week, like didn't miss an opportunity. And so during that, I found a family support group meeting that was right across from the hall from the addiction recovery meeting. So I'm like, do you care if I pop in there, see what that's about? And that's where it really changed for me. Seeing the addict side, I understood it and I got it, the addiction recovery and all that. But I kind of still didn't feel supported there. So I found this family support group and I walked in there and bunch of other people that were in my exact same shoes. And like you, everybody had said earlier, I felt like I was the only one in the world that was dealing with this. Nobody else knows what I feel like.
Yeah.
And so once I started
sometimes
going,
oh, a spouse feels like nobody cares either, because I'm not the one. I don't really have a problem. I don't have the addiction. Yeah. And you, it sounds like you walked across the hall and found your people, huh?
Yeah, I did. And I started attending that, and it worked out perfect. So that was our date nights. It was every Thursday night. And just going there and seeing where people were in recovery. Some people were there for the first week because somebody they loved just found out they were an addict, or they relapsed after 10 years of being clean or whatever like that. It came to the point where they asked me to be a facilitator for the group, and I did that. And
I was doing it for the addiction side, yeah. So it was exciting because he's like, wow, we're like,
yeah,
going to be good.
And it would be cool because spouse would be in the addiction side and their spouse would be on my side, and we knew them mutually, and we knew them outside of addiction, and it was really cool to see that happen. And
some type of ownership, too, of your own, like our own recovery.
Yeah, and the one thing that I wish I could have got right off the bat that I didn't, that it took me a long time and a lot of pain and agony, was to find hope. And so when people were there for the first time, be like, dude, you're in the right place. This is, you're doing the exact thing that you should be doing. I promise you're going to find help here amongst us. And it was, that's where it really excelled, I would say, for me.
Because I was getting that for almost 4 months, you know, like I had gone to treatment. I was going to continuing care once a week. I had a counselor and I was attending meetings. I had that hope because I could see it. I didn't necessarily believe that I could do it myself quite yet, but it never occurred to me that like I was alone, where he was so alone.
And had no one to talk to.
Yeah.
Like family shunned everything.
Friends weren't talking to
friends,
us.
Everything. I just literally felt like I was alone and I was the only person.
That sense of community and connection, yeah. He was totally, I had a piece of it. It wasn't fully developed into what it could be or is now because I didn't have him involved and we were still like really, really rocky. But you need that in recovery of anything. It doesn't even have to be addiction. It could be supporting an addict. It could be having a baby, like just having my baby 5 months ago. I needed that connection and that. You just need people around you.
What's the opposite of addiction, Matt?
Connection.
Connection.
Yeah, there you go. Are you come on.
I got you.
I thought we finished each other's
sentences.
That's right. But I want to go back to something real quick. Because, and I've never heard this, and we've been doing this for quite a while now. You said you had to, in your meeting with your counselor out of jail, that you had to close the back door on pills. What does that mean? Have you heard that before?
Yeah. Tell us what you mean.
Okay. So step one, we admitted we were powerless, right? So I have always had a hard time with that, especially watching my sister and being at a young age exposed to like the recovery world, is saying you do have power. You just have to stop using. But for me, it was like a light bulb switched when I realized that I'm powerless when I'm in an active addiction. What I have power over is shutting the back doors. So going to doctor's offices by myself, I don't do. I have a full at Action Recovery Group. Rick's model is full abstinence. So I don't take allergy medicine. I don't take Benadryl. I don't take NyQuil. I don't.
Anything that has sort of a sedating effect.
Yeah. Any.
Would you take
so many.
Tylenol?
Yeah. Yeah.
But
like
not
Tylenol.
Not something that can alter your state of mind.
Yeah. Anything that can tickle the addict or the craving. So I don't do that. I don't go to people's houses by myself. I don't. What are some other things? Like
it sounds like where you allow yourself to work.
Yeah. Yep. I work at Action Recovery Group as the clinical director's assistant and the intake
because
coordinator.
Because most nursing jobs, you would be around opiates and other, you know, benzodiazepines and other medicines that have addiction potential.
Yeah, and I hear that all the time is, are you ever going to go back to it? Are you ever going to do that? And I just, for me, respect myself enough now to just keep all those doors shut. Why test it, you know?
Yeah, I think closing the back door for most people, what that means is you make hardline permanent changes in your life that remove you from any opportunity to be tempted.
Don't drive by the liquor store if you're an alcoholic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that's what your recovery looks like for you,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, and I think we talk about this on this. When I talk about my recovery is my recovery.
Right.
I live in a world where there's alcohol. I go to family parties where there's alcohol. And that doesn't bother me.
Yeah.
My hard line is not picking it up. Mm-hmm. I mean, not, you know, not doing another one.
What if you were cleaning up, helping, because I know you're a helper, and there's some unfinished beers or things at the family party.
Done it.
You pick them up and throw them away?
Yep, done it. I cleared tables at Maxwell's when I was DJing, so I could get out of there earlier.
Okay.
Yeah,
So something that's interesting about that, too, is you get to a point in recovery where you are very far removed from that, where it's like, oh my gosh, I'm holding it like that. You know, almost like before you're going to use, you kind of almost get high, the sense of that.
Yeah.
You do get away from
your
that.
Your brain has triggers.
Yeah, right. I do also think, though, that those big book thumpers from the, like, they have these set rules, but that's not the case. It's whatever works for you.
Yeah, that's why I say it's my recovery and that's what your recovery. And I think you're setting up your own boundaries.
Yeah.
And I think once you start to test those boundaries, that's where the danger area comes. And
now, have you back? So, one of the things we know in psychology is that our personality is really how we perceive and interact with the world. It's mm-hmm. kind of our autopilot.
Yeah.
So, I would assume you're still a competitive person, mm-hmm. competitive in your recovery. You want to be the best and win and do.
I'm
all
more sober
that.
Than you.
Yeah, I want to see you guys fight it out later. I think I know who'll win. But how about that? Has that can border on kind of getting a little cocky and complacent? Have you ever been tempted to be like, I'm above this? Has that ever snuck back in a little bit?
So it's very interesting. Working at Action now, I do see myself sometimes falling into the sense of, you should just do this. This is what works. But I also know, and it's interesting you say that, because my friend posted on Facebook, are you, like, ask yourself this question, are you so set in your ways that you wouldn't try something new? And I'm like, ooh, maybe I am. And so I've realized that the best part of my recovery that I do now is a moral inventory, a very thorough written moral inventory every day. And I think that keeps me pretty grounded. Granted, it's not trying something new, but I'm very honest with that process. And the humbling part that I try to keep myself going back to all the time is those making amends promptly. And I think that keeps me, I do think that definitely I could get cocky. I definitely feel like that. But I also know it to be true that a big part of my personality has changed since being in recovery.
How would you describe it?
That know-it-all part of the competitiveness in me is definitely dulled. It's mm-hmm. still there and it still comes out a lot. I've noticed that I kind of have to like reel that in, but I just want to know. I want everyone to share their opinions and I want to just embrace it all because I've realized that everyone has something to add to my life in a good way. And that intellectual conversation and triggering my brain and like trying to have these deep conversations is that like what I crave in life now, that authenticity and vulnerability that people can share. And so I do think that recovery has, I don't know, would you say that to be true? That since I've been in recovery, that's
absolutely. Yeah.
See, I like to say that my recovery is always evolving.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I can't tell you what's going to come down in the future, but I mean, I'm open to try new ideas and do that stuff. And I think that's what works for me is that it is evolving.
Trying new methods of staying
sober. New modalities, new ways to look at a thing, a perspective, and trying to be empathetic and trying to see the other shoe. I mean, this one's one of my favorite episodes. I know we say that every episode, and I don't want our guests to think that we say that just because they're here. This is one of my favorite episodes because we got to see both sides of the story so clearly here.
Yeah, that's great.
And I can empathize with both of them, and I can see both sides. And I think it's so wonderful that these guys figured out a way that works for them. Mm-hmm. Now, what they did is not going to work for everybody out there, but you might be able to find something in this that goes, huh.
Well, I think there's some common threads, hope. You guys are both giving back, working as facilitators. I think you also both found your people, right? People that you can really relate to. It's not just Brian going with Lizzie to meetings, but Brian's found his own meetings. And I love the advice of your therapist, or the prediction of your therapist, which was that Lizzie, if she stays in the program and works hard, she's going to grow and develop in ways that'll make Brian feel left behind if Brian doesn't do his own development. Mm-hmm. And I would say that's true in marriage in general.
Yeah.
You know, I want to ask, have you guys done, like, how would you rate the state of your marriage in general right now?
10. Out of 10.
Good job, Brian. That was smart. Smart, yeah. Smart move.
Definitely, though, like, we, these deep conversations and this level mm-hmm. of, like, trust and vulnerability that we have now, never did we have that.
Yeah,
and I was going to say, you know, I'm assuming that this has spurred deep conversations. You're doing daily written meditations. You guys are talking honestly about thoughts and feelings that most couples don't have they don't have a forced reason to do. Mm-hmm. You guys had a forced reason. It was like, we got to do this.
Yeah.
We got to get real with each other, or we're going to be over with.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of couples will live together for 10, 20, 30 years and never really talk to each other.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Have you, what's that like? Do you have, side story, I had a professor in graduate school who's kind of a weird, funny guy. And he had left me this cryptic message, you got to call me this weekend. And I had forgotten all about it. It was like Sunday afternoon, and I was like, oh, I don't want to show up without having called him. So I called him at home, and he answers the phone. He says, hello. And I said, oh, hey, this is Matt. Got your message on Friday. I'm just giving you a call. Oh, I can't talk right now. It's dialogue with my wife time. I'll talk to you tomorrow. And he hung up. And so I thought, hey, that's really cool that they have set dialogue time with boundaries.
Who calls it dialogue?
Weird psychologist. But like my point is, why'd he answer the phone?
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The weirdo answers the phone and says, it's dialogue time. Don't bother me. I'm like, well, don't answer the phone.
Yeah.
Jeez. Anyway, but do you guys do things like that? Do you sit down on purpose and dialogue, talk, even if you're not nerdy and you call it something cooler, like, you know, pre-sex conversation or something?
Whoa.
Some people call that
fun. Wow. Yeah.
We're in marriage therapy
or
mode,
post-coital.
Casey.
We could even make it very I call that.
Are the kids asleep? Are they?
I think something that's interesting about that is that we've always been very, very much like best friends, even more so now. I feel like when Mike and came into our life, my daughter, she kind of came my world, and I kind of put him away, like, I mean, obviously it was crazy, but I think that it's been a big eye-opener to just, he's a silent treatmenter and I'm like we kind of blow up at each other. And now it's like, I don't remember the last time we really got in a fight. Like, we're very quick to say sorry. We're very, mm-hmm. We talk every day on his way home from work. That's 45 minutes we talk on the phone. And once the kids are in bed,
we
just
know
sit
you do.
And talk.
It's okay.
Sleep.
Matt!
Well, Casey, you said, are the kids asleep? And so,
jeez, yeah, we expect do. That from me.
We do. And that.
I'm the therapist. We talk about it all.
That's gotten better, too. So.
Yeah.
That's gotten better, too.
Better way to make
so what? So, what's, if you were to say, what's the formula? Because I will say this. Let me criticize psychologists for a minute and therapy, okay? Psychologists and therapy, one of our big problems has always been really only paying attention to when things go wrong and tearing it down and breaking it apart. But we have gotten better over the last probably 10, 20 years of learning to say, when things go well, are we breaking it down? Are we understanding the formula? What are the ingredients? So I want you guys to give a message to our listeners, whether they're in a marriage that's struggling with addiction or not. What are your ingredients that your marriage is going so well right now? You named a few. Let's recap. What are the things? Bullet points.
I would say my number one thing is communication. When you get bugged or suspect, like an addict, it was just communicate. Don't just assume, oh, she's high again. I know it. I'm not even going to ask, and I'm going to be pissed the rest of the night. So just
like right now, are you saying our tips for right now or during that moment?
Yeah, all
either,
of it.
Either. Yeah. I would just say communication in that time. And then now, where I wouldn't communicate, now I will. Like something's on my mind or something's bothering me or I need help or something, I'll immediately just ask. I won't assume.
And part of communication is these deep conversations that I was talking about. It's like I do my own individual study of with religion and with spirituality, and I immediately share those things. We just continually bounce these like broad and.
But I think that's
grand.
Vulnerability.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's what that is, because mm-hmm. you know, you're willing to share something that's deep inside that you believe with someone else.
Yeah.
And you don't share that with a lot of people. So if you have that one person to be vulnerable with, I think that's amazing.
Yeah. And having fun together. That's something huge that we definitely had fun before, but I think it's something that like as a whole family, we have not let kids slow us down, and we couldn't. When we had Mike, and I think we kind of allowed that to happen, like, oh, we've got a baby now and we have to like do this. But like we've taken her to Ireland twice. We take our newborn little baby and our almost 5-year-old golfing all the time with us. And we don't let that stop us.
Yeah.
And it's good for us.
That's amazing. So now what's Thanksgiving look like at your parents' house?
It's fabulous.
We'll circle
all the way back to that. Since we talked about it earlier, it was slow. It wasn't just immediate. All of a sudden, everybody just with my family. Everybody just dropped the curtain and say, "Okay, welcome back. How's everything going?" You know, it was slow. One by one, slowly people started coming around, and then now my sister, her husband is an addict, and she just found out just this last year. And I spent hours on the phone with her, and one of the things she said, and she was one of them who has never said anything, and she said, "I am so sorry for the way I treated you during this time. I had no idea what you were going through, and I just made assumptions," and she full-on apologized, and I'm like, "It's okay. Like, that's what happened. It was the past, and I'm in a better mindset, so I'm not holding a grudge." I'm like, life's moved on. I understand.
But you don't let her come over, right?
No.
Wow, Matt. What's wrong?
And you know what, though? We've learned through recovery that the best people that we know are in recovery.
Absolutely.
Most amazing, big-hearted, beautiful souls that we've ever met, we found through recovery. So because this has happened to their family, we know what that looks like. We know that our relationship with his sister and her husband is going to be 10 times better. Even though they were in the rock bottom of everything hitting them, I'm like already jumping forward 6 months in my head, like, I can't wait. This is going to be beautiful. We're going to be like so much closer.
What's going to make it that way?
The vulnerability and authenticity of getting real with yourself. Yeah. In turn, you just want to share that. You want to share those parts of your life with other people, that connection.
Yeah.
I love it. This has been such a great episode, and I've really enjoyed watching these two interact throughout the whole podcast.
Yeah, you can tell that they are in sync.
Because normally when somebody comes in here, they'll turn and talk to us, but they've been just talking to each other.
I know.
I've had to fight
for some
but
airtime.
I think that's so cool, and I think this story is going to give people hope. And so if people want to find out more information kind of about the programs that you went or what you guys have done, is there anywhere they can follow you guys?
Yeah, so actiontreatment.com or Action Recovery Group on Facebook. And I have a blog.
She needs to complete it.
Okay,
she's doing each of the steps. And I've been telling her for the last year and a half, 2 years, like, you need to go all 12 steps. You're on 9?
Mm-hmm, or 7.
Yeah. So there's 7 steps up to there that are really good.
RecoveryLizzie.blogspot.com, right?
All right. I love it. Any final thoughts with you, Dr. Matt?
No, I've had a great time.
It's been a great time.
What does your intention bracelet say?
The intention bracelet, this is Hope, Love, and Family Friends. That's for Rebecca Cressman. She's on FM 100. And this one right here, this one, is that what this is?
Yeah, what's that one?
My daughter gave me this when I was in Pinnacle Recovery Center. She made it for me. And so she came up to me and she goes, "Dad, I made you a bracelet." And I said, "Cool." And I'm not really a bracelet guy, mm-hmm. but I looked at it and it says, "Love and Hope." Mm-hmm. And it says, she gave it to me. And I put this on the second week I was in recovery. So I've had it on for over a year. What does yours say?
Mine says Fortify, which I kind of took when we like worked everything out at, not everything, but we were on the mend, and fortify like means defend. Obviously,
yeah.
It's defend like your recovery, defend your family, defend your faith, defend what you believe in, and yeah, it stayed on there, and I think it's cool you have one.
I love it. Lizzie Bryan, thank you very much for coming down and sharing your story. Thanks, I appreciate it so much. Josh, thanks for running the show. Dr. Matt, for all that you do. If you know somebody who needs help, have them do what I did and give Pinnacle Recovery Center a call. I just might answer the phone. Project Recovery is a KSL podcast.
Hey, Casey Scott here from Project Recovery Podcast. When I took my first steps towards confronting my addiction, I needed a program that could help guide me through my recovery. That's why I wanted to tell you about Reprieve Recovery. They are a recovery center for women that recognize the importance of healing the spirit, mind, body, and are located in beautiful Mountain Green, Utah. You can learn more by calling 801-252-6030 or visiting their website at ReprieveRC.com.